This is No Direction's PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage. PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage was made possible thanks to the support of the Roll for Combat podcast, as well as the dedication of our team of volunteers. Due to possibly questionable language, this panel is rated Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
It is 102, so welcome to Secrets of the Paizo GMs.
Yay!
Is that really what this is called?
I think that might be Meet the Paizo GMs.
Everyone's asked, but
I knew it was a verb.
I think that's something.
I'm sure I'm in the right room.
This is part 103 of the Paizo GM series, which is going to continue its 73 parts over the course of the weekend.
There will be homework.
Hi, I'm Crystal Frazier. I'm a developer on the Pathfinder role-playing game. I'm also a writer on Starfinder and do development work for Green Ronin on Mutants and Masterminds and the Age System and, oh goodness, many other things. And to my right
is me. I'm James Jacobs. I'm the creative director for Pathfinder. I've been doing Pathfinder stuff longer than Pathfinder's been around, so I have lots of. I know all the skeletons are buried, except for the ones you have told me about.
It's okay, you'll find them.
I know. It's fun, because you open the cabinet and they fall out, and there's like a violent sting. I don't know how you arrange for those to happen, but.
Roll for initiative, random encounter.
Crystal does have powers of like manifesting. Out of nowhere, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, but it's only ever musical stings.
Oh, okay. Still, it's a good trick. So this is technically called Ask the GMs. So I think for the most of it, unless you have other plots, it's going to be mostly questions then.
Yeah, I like to start out GM panels by saying, what is your one best piece of GM advice that you can impart?
I will answer the question. My best GM advice is to listen to your players. Without your players, you don't have a game, and that makes it very, very important for you to make sure you're running a game that the players want to play in, the players are comfortable playing in, and the players are basically invested in. So it's easy if you already know who you're playing with because you know their styles, you know their interests, you know what they're comfortable with at the table, what they're not, so you can adjust things as needed. If you don't know the players, your first session should be something, even before the session, like get to know them, maybe just hang out, have like a character creation session where you're not actually playing the game. But just figure out who they are and what they want to do, what they want to play with. And the reverse should go with the player support, but this is the GM side of things. And at the same point, walk around when you're GMing. Don't just sit there from the table or the side of the table. If you're walking around, people will pay attention to you more.
Plus, you can look over their notes.
That's right. And you can move.
And whisper in their ears.
Oh, they love it when you whisper in their ears.
And what's your advice?
Just to sort of follow up on yours really quick, remember that the players don't need you as a GM anymore, because now there are a bunch of game masterless RPGs out there. So if you're going to take on the role of the GM, make sure you're doing it like in a way that makes you happy and your players happy, because you can be replaced. And after that ominous note, I think the best advice I have is that the happiest game master is the laziest game master. Do not ever be afraid to steal from published adventures, take maps, take stat blocks, take plot books, take player handouts. Right now you can get back issues of Dungeon Magazine dirt cheap on Paizo.com or at your favorite used bookstore, and I go through those all the time for my home games for, like I said, maps, stat blocks, all kinds of things.
Even pictures.
Yeah, even just pictures for NPCs. Yeah. That honestly extends to letting your players do a lot of the work for you. If you're running any kind of intrigue game or any game where there's some sort of puzzle or something like that, at some point, I guarantee you, your players are going to say, oh my gosh, I'll bet it's this. And they're going to come up with a solution that is brilliant but wrong. But they don't know it's wrong, so you can change it.
And then you're like, oh, you figured it out. You guys are so smart. And that makes you, to them, seem like, oh, that GM is really great. They got all these clues that were really tough when we figured them out.
Yeah, and then they're like, oh, wow, I can't believe what a great GM they are and how carefully they pulled those clues, but we figured it out because we're so good.
Yep.
In fact, like, murder mysteries when I run them, I like to go in without knowing specifically who the murderer is because the players will figure it out for me.
I'm running a Call of Cthulhu game here for Sunday night, and that's kind of the tactic I'm taking with it. A bunch of handouts.
Spoilers.
Is anyone in that game?
You want to be.
Well, swing on by if it's at the start. If there's not, if there's
but now they know who the villain is.
And they don't, because I don't.
The villain is you.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh my god, we're all the villains.
Right. Because we live in a village.
Anyway, any questions?
Yes, questions.
We are mostly here to help give you advice and solve your difficult game mastering challenges and possibly answer world building questions as well.
Yep.
That's still a GM responsibility.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely it's Ask the Paizo GM. So if you want to ask questions about Paizo or the Liar's Starfighter or whatever, listen to what our can do answer them.
One I always struggle with, how do you guys run knowledge checks for monsters? Every table I go to when you're rolling, what information do you give? How do you give that? There's some GMs that are really stingy on it. Other ones like read you the whole stat block. It just seems very vague as to...
It's a weird rule because, as written, it's what? Knowledge check is 10 plus the monster's CR.
Unless it's a common, and it's a 5, and it doesn't even say what a common is.
And the weird thing to me has always been that Zatabes, which is... Anyone here know what a Zatabe is? Oh, see, a couple of you know, you made your checks. It's a CR2 plant that makes you fall asleep and then drains your blood or something like that. But it's CR2, so the knowledge check for a Zatabe should be like 17. How many people here have heard of the Tarrasque? Yeah. That knowledge check is what, CR 35, 40, something like that, so you shouldn't have heard about it. So it's a weird sort of, it's sort of nonsensical in a way, that the more powerful monsters are things that you're going to know less about. The way I've always run knowledge checks for monsters is I'll, when the encounter starts, I'll describe the monster and all of that, and somebody's like, what's that? Now, basically, what I'll ask them to do is ask them to make a knowledge check, and let them choose which knowledge check they want to make. Because if you say, this monster rears up, and it's a bully-looking thing with kind of like skeletal arms and all that, and they're like, what is it? You ask them to make a knowledge or can a check, they're going to metagame it and know it's not undead, it's a construct or something weird. So you ask them to decide what check they want to make. And I also ask them, do you want to know about its offensive abilities or its defensive abilities? Do you want to know how to hurt it or how to defend from it? And then I fall back on that general rule 15 plus CR. And if they make that check, I'll tell them what often if the monster's pretty famous, I'll tell them anyway, because it worked in the storyline, because they know they're fighting goblins or whatever. And then if they hit that check, I'll say, all right, you know that this is a Hydra, and sometimes they breathe fire, sometimes they breathe ice. This one you know is a fire breathing one because it's red, etc. And then for every 5 points they beat that DC, like if the DC's 25 and they got a 35, I'll give them 2 or 3 different bits of information. So kind of let them ask you, I want to know what kind of weapons do I need to hit this monster or something. I generally don't let the player say, what's that? Let me roll and find everything out.
I like to convey it using, if I can, come up with it on the spur of the moment, like urban legends or local myths or things like that. Like, this is a Gorgon. It was, you know, nobody's seen one of these parts since the Paladin Zatargo took one down but was transformed to stone in the process. I don't generally give away all that much with successful knowledge checks beyond, like, one or two abilities and their history, but all of my players are giant nerds who are, you know, study the bestiaries, so...
Yeah, one thing I don't really like doing is preparing, like, either in a bestiary or before at, like, a table of, like, a chart. Like, here's what you know and all that stuff, because players read stuff, too. So, at that point, once you make one knowledge check about a monster, that's kind of getting boring. So, if they find multiple, like, trolls and different stuff, and they roll different rolls each time, you can parse, you can hand out different bits of information.
Yeah.
But you know what the players need to know in order to survive. If you know that they're struggling in the adventure and they're up against a troll, you might want to, you know, softball them. Don't tell them it's a lower DC or something, but say, yeah, this is a troll, and they regenerate really, really fast enough to burn them with acid. And if you know they don't have any acid on them or whatever, burn them with fire or something like that. Kind of just keep them in the world, for certain things, like Crystal was saying, give them some lore, but at the same point, don't give them everything out, because you want someone to be surprised. So. And don't be worried about, like, don't be afraid to, you know, sometime down the road, do something different with the monster and all that.
One of my favorite things is filing the serial numbers of common monsters.
Oh yeah, that's really, really a handy trick.
Yeah.
For the lazy GM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, take the stat block for the Hydra. Describe it as a scorpion with 17 tails. All of a sudden, your players have no idea what they're fighting.
Yeah. And then they make their knowledge check, and you say, oh, this is a Nexian scorpion dreadnought, and it regrows its tails if you chop them off. And their characters might have heard about it, but players don't. And that helps keep everything going.
Following up on that, actually, would you say the same is true for something like a creature with an added template of some kind? Because while saying that something is an abyssal or shadow or whatever version of the dung beetle is like those are things that might actually stand out. Describing something as an advanced dung beetle sounds dumb as hell.
I would usually say something like, well, this is a dung beetle, but you can tell by the spikes on its back that this thing is...
It's a dire dung beetle.
Hey, I just say that this one's tougher than normal. This one's, like, maybe been around for a long time, and it's for whatever, or you can say that it's been magically advanced or something like that. Or it's just, I wouldn't say advanced dung beetle, because you're right, that's sort of meta. But at the same point, keep in mind, too, that it is a game, and that if you say it's an advanced dung beetle, it's not necessarily the end of the world, but you can judge it in the moment, the spur of the moment today. And
I'll usually say, like, if I put the advanced template on one wolf in the pack, I'll say, like, one is obviously larger and controlling the others, or, you know, or this dung beetle is larger than the ones you fought earlier that you just stepped on.
Yeah, it's like the leader of the pack or something like that. And when you're preparing the game and all of that, it's probably a good idea when you're dropping simple templates, especially onto creatures, to know why you're doing it in the first place. Because you don't just, you know, randomly drop those in there. You could say, like, they've been drinking out of this magic pool or something like that.
Or they're older and buffer and bigger.
Huh.
Or they've been eating demon flesh.
Yep, that's also that. That does the same thing. Same with, like,
don't
like
eat demon flesh, kids.
So, like, something more complicated, like a half-fiend or half-celestial, that is such a generic sort of template. There's so many fiends and so many celestials that it could be. At that point, I would almost say something like, this, if you put the half-fiend template on a centaur and say it has extra legs or something like that, I would not just describe it as a half-centaur. I would say, this is a centaur that's you know, part devilish, like it got afflicted with, like, poison from a devilish, and rather than dying from the poison, it just mutated or something like that. So
there's a world of difference between half pit fiend and half lemure.
Yeah.
You want me to question the color?
Sure.
I'll just be the lazy GM.
You in the back?
What is the most odd, weird, awful ball thing in any of the characters that one do?
Oh, I'm trying to figure one out that is, like, if it gets recorded, I won't get in trouble for saying it in public.
Okay. Figure that out. I've got one.
Okay.
So I was running an evil game, which...
Do you really have
first
one?
GM warning.
Yeah.
Be careful when you run evil games, because your players can take things a lot further than you're comfortable with. But my players were actually doing a really good job of not taking things too far for each other or for their game master. They got to this point in the adventure where they had to... Basically, there's a keep on a land that borders another land, and you have to destroy the keep so that monsters can pour over the border and invade. The keep is protected by... specifically by a high-level paladin and a bunch of soldiers and a bunch of clerics, like goody-goody spellcasters, and there's a whole town supporting it. So getting in there, you can't just mosh through it like a dungeon, and it's kind of expected, you know, that my players would go in and they'd hit and run and that kind of thing. But what they decided to do was pose as innocent travelers, stay in the town a while, and concoct a very convoluted scheme where they convinced the paladin in charge of the fort that his highest lieutenant's wife was evil and secretly leading a demon cult, so he would strike her down, thus losing his paladin powers. And leading a lieutenant in the process. Did it work? It worked. It took like 3 sessions instead of just 1 to like invade the fort, but it worked, and they were so satisfied with themselves. It involved heavy use of the spell fiendish healing, fiendish regeneration,
infernal healing,
because it makes you radiate as evil while it's in effect.
Oh.
And paladins can detect evil.
Nice. So the one that made me think about is sort of the same thing. It's a case where something that should have taken 1 session takes a lot more. It was our own second edition D&D module, one of the Mind Flayer adventures. The first one, it starts out with a comet appears in the sky and it's causing all sorts of people to panic because it's a dire omen of evils to come, and of course, this comet is like a mind flayer comet, but it's accurate. One of the players in the group was, I forget the character's name, but he was the gnome rogue, I think, or gnome fighter.
I see problem 1 and 2.
I think his name was, he was a chaotic neutral gnome fighter named...
I see problem 3.
Fighter. Anyway, so he got obsessed with this thing in the sky, and he started calling it like Infernus, and is the god Infernus come to deliver us to the new burning tomorrow? And he basically started this whole cult in the town about Infernus. He was like leaving flyers on the walls and like graffiti and stuff like that. But he did the whole thing in secret because there was a paladin in the group and he didn't want the paladin to get it. And so he did such a good job doing this, and I would basically, you know, every once in a while I'd take somebody aside because there was an element of this game that was like everybody gets these prophetic dreams. So I'd take them all aside one by one and say, your dream is this, your dream is this. And when I took him aside, I thought, oh, whoa, I'm going to start playing Infernus paraphernalia all over the place. And the rest of the party started thinking that was the actual plot. And so everybody else started investigating this Infernus quest. Well, the player character that started was like, oh. So rather than do the actual adventure that was laid out, we spent like 3 or 4 sessions trying to track down the leader of the Infernus cult, and they eventually figured out it was him. I'm like, what? Ha, you want to do the adventure now?
did he make his own chick tracks?
Not really, because we didn't. It was like there was no printing press or anything like that. There could have been, but he was doing stuff like leaving like weird symbols all around the ground. And whenever people were asking us, oh, I heard somebody talking about Infernus cults down by the riverfront. It was fun. It was really fun, but it was not the adventure, and so it was kind of weird.
Yeah, sometimes those are what you need.
Unless you actually have like a hard deadline, like you know, like half your players are like you're playing in college and the semester's ending, and you're not going to have the game together at the end and whatever. Don't be worried about, you know, sidetracks like that, because those often can become the most fun, the most memorable parts of the game, and it might not be what you plan for. But it'll be something that everybody enjoys, and that's also why the lazy GM is good, because if you haven't spent days and days and days preparing one story, and something sidetracks you, and I didn't actually, I mean, you can also use what you've planned for the stories. I think for that one, I had their Infernus Cult investigation led them to this warehouse that the Mind Flayer agents were using to smuggle stuff. And so they got to the warehouse for the wrong reason, but they ended up, you know, going on the map and interacting with the villains and all that. So it ended up working out. It was just very confusing and awkward for a certain
paladin. So you fight through all of the Mind Flayers in the warehouse and then be like, tell us about the Infernus Cult! And the Mind Flayers are like, the what?
It was a fun little situation. And they didn't actually meet the Mind Flayers at that point, because I could have played it off like, oh yeah, you were influenced by the Mind Flayer the whole time, to the guy that started the Infernus Cult.
Oh.
That's deep.
Yeah, but I didn't think of it because I was good.
You know, you can change that story now.
So, alright, let's rewind a little
bit. Oh, right here in front.
When you're GMing and you're starting up a new game and people are rolling up characters, what do you ask your players to give you? Because the best GM, well, one of the best GMs I ever had was like, give me a one-paragraph background and two contacts, because he could use the background to, like, give you personal stuff within the story as you go on, and then the contacts were, like, his deus ex machina. Or just, like, you die in the dungeon, your contact looks for you or something, or, like, you need an item, so you talk to your friend, the fixer, or whatnot.
Those are great. That's a great thing to ask. You don't want to ask your players for, like, give me a 3-page essay on your character, because not everyone's going to be in that. You don't want to ask for nothing, because then you won't be able to customize things for your players. I think asking for them to prepare a short little bio of their character, include contacts. One of the things I really like about Call of Cthulhu is it's got people with dependencies and treasured objects in the new edition of the game. So you just pick, like my aunt, I grew up with my aunt because I was walking on the night of the lecture, and I cherish this old locket I got from my mother. So just two or three little tidbits that you can latch onto. One thing that I've done a lot forever in my games is I will prepare little bits of information for the players. And this is really where the campaign trick idea came from, is you know which game you're going to run. Make a list of, like, bonuses that you can let the player characters check out and pick one at the start of your game. They may pick it because it gives them a bonus to initiative, but if they pick the one that's like, you get a bonus to initiative because when you were previous year, you have 2 days of missing time, you woke up with needle marks all over your neck, and now you have a +2 bonus to initiative. So the player's like, oh! I'll go first! I want that one! They don't know that it's like anyone who picks that trait is the one that has like secretly been infested by the Scourge Lord or whatever. So that's one thing that I do a lot is I'll bribe the players to give me background information even if they don't realize it. And campaign trait type stuff works really well. Or looking around at. Background, right?
Yeah.
All right. Get backgrounds for the new upcoming edition. We'll do something like that, where it's like, what were you doing before you became an adventurer? And just saying that I was a blacksmith or I was a baker or something like that gives the GM something to work with.
Presumably, we'll have tap dates or background.
We will now.
What I like to ask, leaving that aside, what I like to ask for varies by what genre we're playing in. Fantasy, I generally just want a paragraph or two of background so I know what motivates the character and I know, like, if they have any local friends that I can threaten or ransom, if they've got, like, any specific character goals that they want to pursue. For my superhero games, because it's a different feeling and it's set usually just within one city, I'll ask for what I call a 3x3, which is 3 friends, 3 rivals, and then 3 locations in the city that mean something to their character. And, yeah, that gives me, like, 3 NPCs right off the bat that I can, like, use to deliver information to them or imperil to get them motivated in the story. It gives me 3 rivals who, it could be their supervillain arch nemesis, or it could just be the guy at work who's really smug, or, you know, just people they want to best in different situations that, again, I can throw out there to motivate them. And then 3 locations that give me, like, help me flesh out the city a little bit without having to do work myself. But, yeah. And I do, it's been a long time since I've run anything pulp, but I did something fairly similar with like a pulp investigation game I used to do where, you know, I asked about, like, give me your three main contacts that you'll go to first in an investigation, and then give me the three people you never want to have to go to an investigation. Lost track of everybody in what order.
Go!
But really nice fluffy black hair.
Oh, thanks. In the bounds of what you can talk about, as GMs, is there something you're really excited about for second edition that maybe you might have wanted to be able to do in first edition that you really couldn't?
Yes.
I'm going to be somewhat evasive because we got this giant list of what we can and can't talk about from Jason.
Did you read that?
No. So I'm just going to guess. This might be spoiled. It's pretty big. One of the things I'm really excited about that we're looking to do with second edition is give the GM more agency in the game. Part of the problem right now with this current edition is like the perception of rule book. There's so much stuff. And that's a natural side effect of having a game system that's been going for over a decade. But one of the things that I like that we're going to be trying to do is that there's going to be more GM control over what parts of the game are active in a particular game that you're running. I don't really want to get too much more into detail about it, but it's going to be less of a case of like the player buys a book and automatically gets to buy all of the magic items in there because they didn't publish it. Yeah, so that's something that I'm pretty excited about. It doesn't really impact the game as much as more of like, I mean, that's kind of the way it was in first edition. I don't know if you're in quite first or second edition D&D. I assume that it's one person. In that game, the players didn't have as much control over all of the stuff that affected their destiny. And it was too far on that side, because, you know, if you wanted to make a sword fighter and you never found a magic sword, you couldn't be a sword fighter. So third edition, I think, swung that pendulum too far in the other direction where everybody can make everything and do what they want to find. So, kind of swinging it back, finding that kind of mid-zone.
I have learned almost nothing about second edition. Eyebrows deep in first edition with development, and you guys probably know more about second edition right now than I do.
That's also a good point too. It's like right now there's kind of three teams in Paizo in the development area. There's the Starfinder group, which is kind of like in their own little protected nuclear silo. There's the second edition group, which is mostly the designers and Adam and Amanda.
Yeah, off in their ivory tower.
Yeah. But they're like they're basically trying to get that game all set up. They've been running playtests and stuff for a lot of the other people. And then there's like you and me and a couple other people who are
out back by the dumpsters.
There's good stuff in the dumpster.
Oh my god! Did you know people just throw away like half a sandwich?
Yeah. I know. Yeah.
That was a good sandwich.
Yeah, roast beef is still roast beef, even if it gets that kind of rainbow gene.
Trash.
It was spicy. I've been working a lot on like Planar Adventures and Mystery Six and stuff like that, and Return of the Rimlords, and you've been working basically on every other adventure.
Yeah. So. War for the Crown and like Digit Goes to the Beach.
Oh yeah, that's good. Cool. So I'm eager to see what we can do with like just some upcoming stuff.
You up front, you've been really patient.
So you talk about sort of rolling with the player's punches and wanting to remix and incorporate their suggestions and things. At least when I was starting out DMing, that was really stressful and hard to do. And I don't know if you all remember sort of that transition period of learning experience and if there were tips or moments you could point to show your growth in that area.
Well, I started in high school running games entirely for 14-year-old boys who are somewhat challenging to keep on task, it turns out. So I feel like I learned under fire. I had a group starting out that just opposed any kind of narrative or direction or instruction. So my first 2 or 3 years of GMing were basically running entirely based on what they gave me.
Yeah, that's really
a yeah, good and it's exposure for that. It's very much a skill you learn over time, so it's scary starting out, but it gets easier and easier as time goes
like,
on.
Like with a lot of stuff, practice, you know, makes it perfect and all that. And yeah. if you're gaining, if you're just starting out, if you're gaining with friends, that really, really helps.
It also helps at the end of each session to ask what you think you want to do in the next session, or ask your players what they want to do in the next session. Like, do you think you're going to chase down this lead? Are you excited to meet this NPC? Do you have, like, any weird ideas you want to spring on me now? Because I need a little time to prepare, and if you spring to the beginning of the next session, I'm just going to have to squash it.
Squash
in the dumpster,
too.
Oh, man, yeah.
It was soft.
Yeah, it was. Wait, I don't think that was squashed.
It was squashed.
Oh, no, that's not, yeah, okay. It was good.
Alright, over here with the blonde hair.
What do you guys think of in the making, like, memorable NPCs?
Flaws.
Likeable NPCs.
Like, well, that's, I think,
those are very different things.
I think for memorable NPCs, making them so that they aren't perfect, like they have weird sort of flaws or like quirks or something like that, like, it's you could just have, like we did in the Game Master Guide, Rich Pet is great for building these things, I think it's good. Just like if you have a list of like weird quirks for NPCs, just feel free to roll on that. We introduced when I was running a game. For like 50 developers, it was basically a temple level unbelievable. And
I mean, keep in mind, only 4 or 5 developers could show up at a time.
Yeah, that's true. But in that case, they went to the town moneylender, which was just the guy you go to get your money, and he doesn't really have anything else. And I had kind of a list of like just weird quirks and stuff like that, and I decided this guy was really into cheese. But cheese was not really into him, so then he would eat cheese and it would make him kind of sick. So he was kind of wheezing and eating cheese. And use voices, that helps.
Yeah. Oh, could you pass that the kuda? It's delicious.
And then the player characters got really worried for the money lenders. Like, he's
sick.
Something's wrong with him. We need to figure it out.
Intolerant.
Yeah. Well, that's basically what it was. And he kind of stuck out. And so then later in the adventure, when the assassins in town did their thing, I killed off the moneylender and it got them really worked up. Like, I killed what? And then, of course, they got framed for killing the moneylender and all that. So, but doing that is my trick. Just try to have like a couple of like ideas. Like maybe before the game, jot down like likes cheese, but is gets sick from cheese. Has a pet cat called Spido, you know, just weird things like that.
Oh, Mike.
Mike the cat. Mike cat. Mike.
Mike cat.
Mike cat. Mike. That's a good one. Yeah. For friendly PCs, that's a trickier one. And by friendly, you mean like PC, like NPCs you want the players to like.
Yes, NPCs that they
yeah.
That they don't kill.
Yeah, the thing there that I've found is the best way to handle it is to make sure the NPCs admit out loud to the PCs that they are awesome. So if you, for example, want the town sheriff, if you want PCs to like the town sheriff, when something bad happens, have him side with the PCs in a dispute or something like that. Have them, you know, compliment the PCs or you know, like say, hey, I like how you killed that goblin. Have this gold nugget.
First prize!
How's your
So, for good, friendly NPCs that your PCs will like, yeah, praise is a great idea. Small rewards are a good idea. Like, if the PCs didn't even know they were doing an NPC a favor, and their first interaction with an NPC is them saying, whoa, thank you, I didn't think anyone would ever do this, and getting a prize, they'll remember them more. They'll be more positively, like, inclined towards them. It helps just knowing your players. Like, some players will bond to the whoopee, like the character who's just a sad sack who needs their help. And other players will hate that character. Some players will love the, like, earnest, gosh darn shucks, like, homespun, nice guy, and other players will put the dagger right through him themselves.
that's a great point. The more you play with your characters, you more that you know what they are like.
Yeah,
and you'll be able to play through it. Play through the audience. No.
For memorable characters in general, it helps to pick one or two verbal tics you can use as the GM, and always work that into the character's dialogue. It just makes them stand out in their memory, because as a GM, you can only do so many voices. But if there's a noble they have to interact with, who's the one who doles out the rewards? They don't want to kill him, but he's got the most annoying laugh. Then they're going to remember that guy. He's like, "What great job out there!" I've got one player who will try and strangle me anytime I do that laugh in public.
Nice. That's how you know you're doing your job right.
I'm also married to that player.
So. Oh, no. That's different. That's your own little result.
So, over here on the far?
So, character infighting. For example, you've got character A, he's a hardcore Farazzo worshiper. And then you got character B, he does a little bit of necromancy in front of them. Now character A wants to kill character B. When do you intervene? Do you intervene?
You do intervene.
You do have to intervene, sometimes away from the game table itself.
Yeah. Because a lot of times that sort of thing is not an in-game thing, that's a real life conflict where somebody's got some sort of issue or problem going on. And, That's probably my least favorite part of being a GM, but it's also the most important part about being a GM. Is you're kind of a mediator. You got to kind of watch out for people, like when real life is good, or they start fighting against each other and all that. Sometimes both players are into it and they enjoy that deep dive into role playing. And basically, what I do is when it starts feeling awkward, and keep an eye on the other players too, if they're looking like they're getting any cues or anything like that, take them aside and just say, "All right, let's have a break and go grab some paper or something," and just talk to them. Is that the X card thing?
Oh, like every player has the ability to hold up an X card and say, "We are taking things too far.
Yeah.
We need to slow down and back off."
Just let everybody in the party know that. If you're ever feeling uncomfortable, just that's okay to stop the game. Because you're there to have fun. You're not there to, break up friendships.
Yeah, and the X card is an idea you'll see a lot more in horror games or other games that, or like romance games like Monster Hearts, where you might be pushing each other's comfort levels or boundaries more without realizing it, just as part of the gameplay.
Yeah.
So, but it's not, or it's still something you can import into, your everyday game table. The idea that players, who are there to have fun and are contributing as much as everybody else, have the right to say, "This is going too far in a bad direction, or in a direction I'm not comfortable with."
If it's a case where, like you're specifically saying, where it's two character concepts are diametrically opposed, that's one of the reasons why I really like, at the start of the game, getting people to talk together about working on their characters and all of that, so that you can kind of keep an eye on those sorts of things before they happen and say, "Hey, well, if you're playing the Bresnan Worshipper, maybe you should be playing a Necromancer type thing," and you should keep that in mind. Sometimes that can make for some fun in party conflicts, which can be rewarding, but if it gets too much, I would basically just take them aside and talk and say, "Hey, this isn't working out." And give even them the option of retiring a character, rebuilding a character, or changing a character. Like don't penalize them for the choices that just didn't end up working out. Let them rebuild characters and do something with
them. Yeah, or it's also possible to explain one reaction or another as a heat of the moment desperation thing. Like, "I had to do the necromancy because we didn't have any other solutions," and that can be something they negotiate in character so that it doesn't come up again, or it could lead to a friendly in-party rivalry, or if it's something where they want to kill each other, then that's, and it's distracting from the game and ruining one or both people's fun, then that's the time to take it away from the game table itself and talk to them.
And actually, don't be afraid to stop the game entirely and say, "Okay, that's this, we're going to obviously something weird is happening. Let's stop the game for now and just take a week until the next session to like cool down and think it over. And then at that point, talk to you and figure out what's going on. Worst case scenario, you might want to consider asking one of them to step away from the game or something like that. I've actually had that situation where two players in the group, they hated each other, right? Because of other games that were happening with other GMs and stuff. They had like this whole secret assassination plot against each other that just went really sour, and it spilled over into other games and all that. And my solution at that point was to say, hey, you two obviously don't get along. I'll run, and this was sort of a bad idea in the long term from my side, but I basically said, I'll run this game with this group, and then I'll run you in a separate game. Basically split the party in two, so that where I ran two games. It was bad idea for me because I just didn't have the time to run two games at a time, and one of them eventually kind of petered out. So, but yeah, that's a tricky one, and it's really you know the people who are having the trouble taking the side.
So in the back here, in the gray shirt.
So speaking of burning the candle at both ends and prepping and running. Games, how do you avoid burnout, and how do you, once you, if you've taken, like, say a 2 month break from a game, how do you come back to it without losing that continuity? How do you prevent and recover from burnout?
For me, it's playing the game instead of GMing the game is one way to do it. If you play for a while and GM for a while, or if you have a game where you play and a game where you GM, that really helps to keep things interesting. Sometimes you just have to take a step away from it and say, hey, I'm worn down. I don't want to keep going. Don't be afraid to like just stop a campaign that isn't quite done, and then 2 or 3 months later, don't be afraid to start at something entirely new. So.
It helps to have a second hobby, something like that, that doesn't require as much pre-planning. Creative hobbies, I found, tend to work best for me, but I don't know if that's going to be universal, but something simple. I do art personally to get around, and sometimes that actually helps me find good GMing solutions that I wouldn't have thought of otherwise, because I tend to spin over story ideas and character development in my head while I draw scenes. As for recovering, playing for a while helps so that that burden is off you. Before you get back into GMing, once you're there, or once you're ready to, I found that writing a summary of everything that's happened and sharing it with your group to see if they can fill in details that they were excited about that maybe you didn't catch helps a lot.
Whoa.
So, over here, with the microphone. We're in the last 10 minutes, so we are in the lightning round. Keep your question to 30 seconds or less.
Are there any character options that you just do not allow at your table? Classes, races?
Yes. Generally, I try to limit races to what's in the core book, and if you have a good reason or it's kind of setting appropriate, then stepping outside for races or character options are fine. No vivisection alchemists.
I generally, it depends on game. Sometimes everybody has to be a human, sometimes say everybody has to be something that you want. It really by game, by game.
I had a really fun all clerics game at one point. In the red up front.
So, trying to think of how to phrase this in a really quick way to make sure no one I know is here. So, I have some difficulty with a player of mine who is very knowledgeable of the rules, and in a lot of instances knows things more, like how to do things more technically than I do sometimes, but this has led to a number of instances of him arguing with literally the rest of the party for extended periods of time about how to do things or whether or not to do things, and I don't always know the right moment to step in and say, so as the GM, I'm going to say this doesn't matter, is
a lot of,
big question.
Yeah, a lot of that is, you know, reinforcing that everybody gets control over their own players. There are some people who feel like there is a right way to play the game and get frustrated when they see other people playing it the wrong way. And it's not necessarily a bad trait. You can actually co-opt that to be a good use for you by making him your rules deputy. At a lot of my tables, because my wife is a lot more familiar with the rules than I am, I actually have her there as my, like, backup GM reference person. Like, how does this spell work? How does this rule work? How does grapple work? Because we've done it 1,000 times, but it doesn't stick. Ironically.
That's a great solution. Use them as a basically a living reference again, but then take them aside and say, hey, this is what I'm going to do. I tell them, you are better with the rules, so I'm going to periodically during the game say, hey, how does grapple work? How does this work? How does it work? But let's keep it to that and let the game roll out. And if something happens in play that's like maybe a rule gets used the wrong way, but the game is going on, steps into, like your room, say, just have them keep like a note on paper and just write down like things like that. And then at the end of the game, sit down and talk about it. So just basically keeping it to post game discussion. Really.
Sure.
Yeah, and I mean, just remind him that some people aren't going to play the game the same way, and that's fine. You're not going to penalize anybody for not picking the optimal solution.
It's a tough situation. I think every GM has got one where you're running a game and there's a player that knows the world better. So it's really just, you really need to sit down with them at the start or at some point say, hey, I'm the one in charge and I need you to support me in that way because it's not fun to just spend more time like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
In the green shirt back here?
Yeah, so kind of to touch up on some of the other questions before, how do you handle a player that wants to play, whether it's a race or class, for a particular, like, say, adventure cap example, good example, Second Darkness, not friendly with paladins, but they insist on playing a paladin? How do you usually handle that?
I will basically tell them, hey, this is not the best choice to play a paladin. Like, Skull and Jackals is an even better one.
Exactly.
If you want to play a paladin as well because it's going to be a challenge. Just let them know, really.
Yeah.
If we're playing a goblin in Return of the Rise of the Rune Lord, because the first adventure about a goblin.
Being a hobgoblin, Iron Fang invasion.
Hobgoblin, and we see that every time we do an adventure path. We say, this is the adventure path where you probably don't want to play Worshippers of Nemesis. And suddenly everybody wants to play Nemesis.
Yep, because you made it the forbidden fruit.
Yep. Just let the players know that is not... Either say, set that character or concept aside for the next campaign and do something different. Or go in eyes open knowing that that's probably going to be too complicated and too unrewarding any choice to make. And give them the option later on in the game if they decide it's not fun to replace the character.
Yeah. Sit down, talk to them, find out what about that character concept makes them want to play it.
Yeah.
Because they might have reasons that sound really appealing to you once you understand them, and you might want to run with it.
It might just be actually a case that they don't want to play the adventure path that the rest of the group wants to play.
There's also that.
And in that case, it's like you might want to think about maybe doing a different adventure path and just telling that player, like, well, we're going to do this because everybody else wants to play it, and maybe you sit out or...
Yeah.
There's a lot of options, but just communication. Room for two more, I guess.
All right, here are the gray stripes.
What advice would you give if you have a player who is so attached to their character that they've made it clear that if that character dies, they're going to leave? And how do you get them to get into a backup character to roll them in, for particularly a Rune Lord AP is overplayed?
There are a couple of ways you can handle that. You can run with it and make a situation where instead of killing characters, you imperil them once they're down to zero hit points. It's one of my favorite ways to handle it because I like continuity of story. So when you're reduced, basically, the way I run it is that only big name NPCs can kill a PC character. Like, your average goblins, your average guards, that kind of thing can only really knock you unconscious and drag you to the boss. At which point the boss throws you to jail and you have to escape, or throws you into an overly complicated death trap that you have to figure out, or, you know, puts you somewhere where they get to monologue for a while and then wander off and leave you to much easier to handle guards.
That's a good solution because I agree the continuity story is important. You build up an entire venture campaign and the characters die, you simply lose that through line. Having options rather than death when you get to negative hit points is a really great solution. Also, one thing that I do a lot in my games is I allow the players to discover like a scroll of resurrection or a ring of wishes or something like that. I basically get out of death free card or hero points or something like that. Give the players a mechanic early on that is a kind of an escape hatch for those situations. And if you give back a scroll of resurrection out to the party on the third level, not only does that set up like a potential like escape hatch for them if the die roll is going to come on somebody. It feels like treasure at that point. A lot of players are used to, like, third level, we're going to get 473 experience points and 623 gold pieces for each encounter. And they've got it down to a science. And when they get something that's outlying of that, it feels interesting and exciting.
And then they think you're going to try to kill them.
Yeah. and then probably one more. We don't have any.
Okay. I've asked so many questions, so I apologize. But,
well, I'm going to have a seminar. We'll answer them.
Sure.
But, 75-part series.
shoot, and now I don't remember what. No, actually, this is something I've been wondering about. Is there... As a GM, you are running the game and trying to presumably move things forward. Is there, like... Is there any reason to, like... I'm supposed to put this... The only thing I can come up with is not cheat. Which doesn't make me sound great, but that is, I guess...
Basically, like, fudging the rules and stuff like that?
In order to cause certain things to occur, I suppose.
Cheat. By all means, cheat.
You know what the story is supposed to be and where the story is supposed to go, and you hopefully have the trust of your players that you're there to provide an entertaining story. And it's okay to like just say something happens, or just roll the dice behind the screen, or just make things happen the way they happen. The trick is, you should do that when it's in the player's favor. You should never do that when it's against the players. So you shouldn't say, like, in order for this adventure to play out, the party has to be captured by the guards. And therefore they automatically have to lose in the fight. That's no good. If you want to do that adventure, it's best to start the adventure, the entire campaign, with them already in prison, because they didn't have any agency before that. That's why, for like Surface Skull, that adventure starts with the player characters being shipwrecked on an island. That doesn't happen halfway through, because there's a lot of chance for the player characters to save a ship from being shipwrecked. That's why Skull and Shackle starts with people being trusting into the ship. If you have a plot line like that, it's best to start thinking of that. And if you like running those types of adventures, keep them like in your satchel or your back of your head or whatever, because it'll eventually happen just by chance. That's my advice: is don't be worried about cheating if it's in the player's favor. Try not to do it if it's not, because you'll lose their trust.
Sure.
There's times where you just have to ignore the rules. Like, if your adventure is about trying to figure out who killed the king, and the king is, like, a fourth-level aristocrat, well, he's probably got, I don't know, 22 to 35 hit points, and if you just find him with one dagger in his back, that's a d4 damage. That shouldn't kill the king. But, for the sake of the story, you find him with a single dagger standing out of his back. I mean, there are times where the rules don't make story sense, and it's okay to fudge them or throw them out the door for the interests of moving the story forward.
And really, the rules, a large part of the reason the rules exist is so that there's an impartial element to the game, that the player characters can trust being a stable foundation for their stories and their characters to build out on. And the more trust the player characters have in you, the more you can jiggle that stuff. Sure. They just have to. Players want to be there to have fun. If they don't, if they think the GM is out to get them, they can't trust the rules there to prevent
them. Remember, the rules are largely a combat simulator, not a story simulator.
I like to think that I've fostered a sense of trust in my players where they know I'm out to kill them, but also want to have them to have a good
time. This is a weird sort of, like, line to walk. Cool. Well, thank you, everybody. If you have more questions, feel free to come to other seminars we're in and hijack those and ask us questions when we're not ready for it, because we love being blindsided by unanticipated questions.
Oh, yes. Next up in our session, tell the Paizo GMs, where we will sit here and you tell us how to run our games. Which isn't an actual seminar. Please don't come to our other seminars and tell us how to run our games.
Watch out for the good ideas.
Yeah, if you think you can do our job better than us, yeah, by all means.
We like to buy your games, too. Thanks, everyone. Have fun.
Thank you for joining us for another PaizoCon 2018 seminar recording. Special thanks to the KDCon team, including Justin Sluder, Ryan Hiller, Stephen Glicker, and the entire Roll for Combat crew. No Direction's PaizoCon coverage would not be possible without their tireless effort. To find this and other great Pathfinder podcasts, visit nodirectionpodcast.com.